Welcome, everyone. We are so excited to kick off season two of our special series, Love at Work. We loved producing last year's series. We've learned a lot from our guests. We've learned a lot about ourselves and about the business world. What we'd like to continue to explore is this provocative idea around whether or not love at work truly creates value. Joining us today is Stuart Woolard. Stuart will introduce himself, but I'm thrilled to have him here as he embarks on a new adventure, which he'll describe to you. And then we'll talk a little bit with Stuart about ideas around where love at work lives in the work that he's doing, and some ideas about where the antithesis of love shows up and how it informs value creation or value destruction in organizations. Stuart, it's a pleasure to have you here. Would you share with our audience who you are and what you're doing?
Great. Well, thank you very much, Laura. My career started quite a long time ago, in 89, actually. I worked in the tax practice at Arthur Andersen, which for those of your older listeners and viewers will know doesn't exist anymore. And I was in that experience. I got involved in probably the world's first global human capital practice. But then I left shortly before an organization of 85,000 people collapsed extremely quickly, which showed me how fragile organizations were and how instrumental human beings were to the cause of corporate scandals and catastrophic failures. So that was pretty, interesting time. Since then I've run my own businesses. I've worked for the leadership team for E-Trade Financial, their international business, and I've worked in academia through King's College, what's now King's Business School, working with a number of universities such as Cornell in the States and Tilburg in the Netherlands, really connecting organizations to evidence and research and the use of data to make better decisions about how we manage organizations through a human lens. A little over 10 years ago, I set up the Maturity Institute, a not-for-profit institute, which was all about building a bridge between, using the words people are our greatest asset and then understanding, well, okay, how much? how much do people matter? And building a methodology to quantify human value and understand risk being the other side of the kind of value coin. And more recently, I have, after working with the investment world for quite a long period of time, kind of gone back into a corporate context and was invited to be part of a startup, which is really about building what we call human value operating, a human value operating system to build a software platform which can deliver data and insights that can sit alongside financial performance, not just on a biannual basis or even a quarterly basis, but can yield important insights primarily for leaders, from CEOs, COOs to CFOs, on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis. So really providing a system and a tool through which people can manage their whole human ecosystem alongside financials, which is where our work started, really in quite a serious way just over 10 years ago. So that's a very, very short history on what seems to be quite a long career. And I'm sure we'll have some deeper discussions about that as we go.
No doubt. Stuart, I'd like to start our conversation talking about your take on the idea of love at work. Does love belong at work?
Well, it's interesting. I now you talked about that. I actually went to spoke at a workshop probably about 10 years ago, and I think it was a guy, Professor Roger Steer, actually gave a session on love at work, and he was kind of preaching to the converted because most of the audience were chief people officers or then probably heads of HR or HR directors. But I think, when you sort of, the way we look at organizations and when you look at people through a value lens, the starting point is that you should be fundamentally caring about your organization, the people within your organization, and actually that it's not a soft and fluffy thing. Caring about people, generally in a both a professional and a personal context, is not just important for the individual, but it's important for the organization, and in fact it's important for the whole set of human stakeholders that everybody touches within that context. And the idea really is that, you know, well, for us, organizations, certainly for the last 50 years, have operated on a more exploitative footing, if you like. Value comes from extraction of effort, pushing people harder, with less and less regard for the individual themselves or the teams themselves. And this comes back to my point, when you increasingly focus on financial performance and you run your organization through a financial lens, the sort of dehumanization means that care and love are things that don't feature too often. And you might build things around the workplace to alleviate the consequences of how you're running the organization. So certainly when you look at things like well-being or mental health, you might provide various support, but you push the onus back onto the individual. And a lot of the approaches are literally putting sticky plasters on things or putting a lid on a pressure cooker, which, you know, is continuing to boil. And I think the point about going back to fundamentally caring about the people that work for you, the people within your organization, is that, you know, the trade-off between people and profit, we can eradicate. We don't need to manage our organizations on that basis. That doesn't mean you don't make hard decisions about how you manage people, but fundamentally you care about them. And if you have to make hard decisions, you do that in a very respectful, fair way. So, for example, if you make people redundant, fire people, you don't do that through a text. And you don't do that through a loud hailer, which was my first client back in the late 80s, went out to a trading floor and did it that way.
Wow.
You do it with, you allow people to be treated, well, you should be treating people fairly and give them the dignity that they deserve. They might not accept your decision, but you do it in a way which respects the person. And that actually is managing your organization in the way that it should be managed, because that person who does leave might not accept it, but they do respect the way you handled them. They're not going to be bitter. They might buy from you in the future. They're not necessarily going to badmouth you. And most importantly, your coworkers that remain look at how you're treating people on the way out. And that's a really important message to send, is because if you don't love or you don't care people in that context, then the message you send to the rest of the workforce is, we don't care about you either, uh-huh. Even though you keep your job. And that has quite a big impact on their motivation and their effort at work.
Uh-huh. It, for me, this conversation raises the issue of whether or not the construct of love at work is a continuum that moves from being loved at work or loving your colleagues, caring for them as subjective individual human beings, and unloved at work, which feels to me like a risky proposition, right? The creation of toxic work environments, letting people go through text messages or, you know, the old pink slip conversation or just the pink slip. Does the risk mitigation component of this conversation live on that unloved end of the continuum? Or is it not a continuum at all? Is it some other framework?
Yeah, I mean, the way we rate and assess organizations today is we do rate them on a continuum. So, you know, from, well, let's describe them extremely, well, places where there is, you know, are devoid of love, which, mm-hmm. you know, modern slavery, you know, treating people, you know, very much as a pure commodity. You know, these places exist. They exist in the UK. They exist everywhere. And we tend to think that slavery was something that happened in the 19th century. It happens today. And so there are workplaces that are genuinely, you know, highly extractive, highly exploitative, and fundamentally deliberately dehumanized. And I think that's at the extreme end. And, you know, we rate those organizations, like if you think about a credit rating, we rate them at D or below. And fundamentally, you're in a place where it's not just unloved, it's, you know, borderline, if not criminal. You know, you are mm-hmm. generally breaking some kind of law. And there is a continuum as you go up the scale, right? And we kind of talk about a midpoint where organizations start, you know, if you're at the lower end of the scale, the kind of left-hand side of the midpoint, fundamentally you see people as a cost of doing business, and you know, you've got that continuum from, you know, managing them as a cost, but maybe, you know, having some kind of professionalism around how you manage HR, perhaps, or you comply with the law and you do things in a reasonably professional way, all the way down to organizations that just ride roughshod over that process. So in that sense, we can see a continuum. And then you get over this threshold, what we call a kind of a human value threshold, where suddenly the mindset shifts and you realize that you shouldn't be managing people as a cost of doing business, but actually you should be managing them as human beings that are fundamental to sustainable and sustained performance and value. And when that mindset shifts, then you see quite a profound change in how the organization operates. It starts to build systems that support that mindset and practices which support that mindset. And of course, you have a continuum the other way, where we would argue, you know, there are what we describe as highly mature organizations in the context where I doubt they would describe themselves as workplaces that espouse love, but I think they would have no problem with espousing the idea that they fundamentally care about the human beings that work with and inside their organizations. That is a fundamental tenet or an underlying foundation of who they are as an organization. And of course, particularly in large organizations, it's, you know, to build an organization at scale with that kind of culture and those kind of systems takes a lot of time and careful design and that mindset that is not just talked about at leadership and management level, but is practiced day in, day out.
Stuart, you work quite a bit with professional services organizations, particularly inside of frameworks that are built on time and materials basis, billable hours, that kind of thing. So I'd love for you to share a bit about how these concepts and the opportunities for value creation or value loss for these organizations might play out in places like law firms.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, it's interesting. I met with a junior lawyer only a few weeks ago, must be in his early 20s, who was talking about how, you know, in his own workplace, you know, what he puts down on a timesheet or what he charges as hours is the way he's managed in a work context. And, you know, the hours are become targets. The hours that you bill or you charge are routes to promotion and bonuses, and also avoiding difficult conversations with people who are, you know, managing your own contribution through the lens of time, and the time you put into your computer or put on a piece of paper or whatever. It brought me back to, you know, in the US you'd call it the fall of 1989, when I sat across from a partner, my first performance appraisal, who congratulated me on my chargeable hours, and I walked out of that meeting thinking, what on earth was all that about? I mean, is that all that I am? And the legal sector primarily has a business model which has been retained for many decades, which captures people's time and builds clients based upon the time that they put on the client account doing client work. The frame of reference of value with respect to a typical law firm is how many hours have you done? How much revenue do we recover from those hours? So targets become set around how many hours you should do, whether it's, you know, 1,800 or 2,000 or whatever. If you do those, you get a big, you know, tick and gold star, and you're looked after, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with that is, well, there's the number of problems. From a human perspective, you're reduced to seeing your contribution through the lens of charging time to a client. So that incentivizes certain behaviors, certain outcomes. It makes a lot of law firms incredibly inefficient. It fails to capture the true and full value that an individual can bring to the workplace, because it's focused on a very narrow lens, essentially output and productivity. And, you know, things like, you know, quality, innovation, and even, you know, as I said, efficiency and wider impact are just, you know, they are very much secondary factors. And you know, we know from a litany of corporate failures, both within You can start to think about them. We all know that Boeing focused on the financial earnings of its business to the detriment of the quality of its aircraft, and consequently have gone through a very long period of aircraft failures. And that's well documented. And we've seen that time and time again when you focus on certain aspects of value, whether you're driving output, like Volkswagen did when it tried to chase down Toyota as the world's biggest car maker. It incentivized the creation of a cheating emission system, which caused a catastrophic reputational damage, to which, VW continue to struggle with today, I would suggest. They're just two of many, many examples where if you reduce the management of someone to how many hours they do or how many products they make, then yeah, you can run your business in a certain way, you can achieve certain outcomes, but you're unlikely to be maximizing the potential of any individual, you're unlikely to be maximizing the potential value of your organization, and you're also highly likely to be carrying material human risk. And that's what we've seen play out time and time again. I gave as far back as the Enron scandal and the collapse of my previous employer, Arthur Andersen, the litany of failures has been a constant stream. And time and time again, we go back and we look in the rearview mirror and say, oh, that was a culture issue. Mm. That was a human issue. It was the failure of decisions. It was how this organization was being managed. Which comes back to the first point is, well, unless you measure and manage your organization through a human lens, if you're primarily just looking at numbers and you're targeting numbers, you're going to get outcomes which are going to cause harm at some point. And it's no surprise. I mean, you can almost point to any major global corporate there's a litany of some kind of scandals that, appeared. And they don't just appear once. They tend to appear regularly because the system which underpins these organizations is still primarily managing the financial side of the business, well above understanding and managing the human side, if you like.
So, Stuart, what's the antidote? How do we make a change? I mean, this is paradigm level change, not just process change.
Yeah, the good thing is that, we don't need to go into the realms of theory or hypothesis about what kind of organizations that we could be running, which actually are human-centric, right? So we know that there are organizations that their business model is based on managing value through a human lens, managing their value through their people. And we also know that those organizations tend to outperform their peers. So, we've rated and assessed, many hundreds of organizations now, and you can identify, what we would regard as exemplar organizations where human beings do come first. And it's not necessarily about espousing values of love and happiness, but it's fundamentally about valuing the individual as a human being and caring about that individual as a human being. So we could go to automotive and look at Toyota and look at their history over the last 70 years. How many thousands of organizations have tried to copy the Toyota production system, mm-hmm. but failed to understand that it's very much a human system. That's the bit that makes it work. That's the bit that right. means that Toyota's operating margins tend to be much higher than Ford or General Motors or VW, and not just over one or two years, but over decades, right? So I suspect, whenever I look, Toyota's market value has always been three, four, even five times that of its historic competitors. Obviously, Tesla is a bit of an outlier, but generally speaking, Toyota has outperformed its sector over decade. When we look in banking, we have organizations like the Swedish bank Handelsbanken, which is an organization which is run very much about pushing out, empowering people, giving them autonomy and responsibility to run their various parts of the bank in various locations, building very, very high trust organizations, respecting people, caring fundamentally about who they are. Again, when you look at the performance of that organization in financial terms, it's outperformed its peers, again, for the last 50 years. Its operating margins are, again, well above others. And it makes no apology for saying we should be the most profitable bank in the sector. But fundamentally, our business model is about delivering value to the human beings that we serve as customers and the people that work with us and the other human relationships we have as part of our organizational whole system, if you like. So, you know, Mercadona is another one. Spanish supermarket is generally adopted a kind of a Toyota type model, but it talks about itself in a very different way and manages itself in a very different way. It's got a pure stakeholder value model. It talks about its organization as a true learning organization, a project of constant transformation where it's all about galvanizing and engaging everybody that connects to the organization and generating value. Again, it's gone, you know, I think it dominates in the Spanish supermarket sector in terms of market size. It's customer service is generally at the top end, if not the highest. And so its financial success has been phenomenal, yet it's fundamentally a human organization as a construct and as a business model and a set of systems which drive value. So going back to your point is that, you know, we need more of these organizations, right?
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is partly why we set up what we call the Maturity Institute, which is to show what these organizations look like. What are the common characteristics in cultural terms but also in systems terms? You know, they might operate in different sectors, but there are fundamental underlying tenets which exist in all these firms. You know, things like high trust, you know, valuing everybody, ensuring everybody's got a voice, making sure decision-making processes include everybody that can add value to a decision, you know, empowering, creating autonomy, allow, you know, getting people to make decisions all the way down, whether you're on a production line or if you're in a local bank branch, you make decisions as close as you can to either the factory floor or the customer. You know, in the States, you have, you know, a variety of organizations, you know, Costco probably being one of the, you know, what that's, you know, probably, I would argue, not just become a role model, but I think has helped to reshape an organization like Walmart, for example, mm-hmm. where, you know, I remember there's a fantastic paper that compared Walmart, Sam's Club and Costco and showed how a people-centric organization like Costco, which espouses all the things I talked about, fundamentally caring for people, managing, paying them well, trusting them, you know, promoting them, you know, fundamentally was a highly inclusive organization and understood the relationship between that and the value that it brought to customers and the value that then customers brought to the business in financial terms. And you know, that comparison has been well made now. There's a professor, Zeynep Ton, out of MIT originally, wrote a book called The Good Job Strategy and has done a huge amount of very influential work in retail, showing how Costco, you know, organizations like Costco and Mercadona, I guess Trader Joe's, maybe another one, organizations that really do put human beings front and center of their business model outperform, right? So when people are really galvanized, truly empowered, truly motivated, they don't just do their task. You know, they come to work, they identify improvements, they work as a team, they collaborate, they share, they communicate, you know, they do all the things which we're told are, you know, important aspects of a high performing organization. So the notion that there is a trade-off doesn't exist when you look at organizations that understand about building those human, you know, organizations that put human beings front and center and fundamentally drive value through people. Yeah, we can bust the myth, and you hope in doing so that you get others to copy. But the problem, as you just kind of said, is that we have a system which is built the other way around. So we have business schools that still embed profit maximization and shareholder value that was constructed decades ago within a lot of the curriculum. There's no alternative. So, you know, economic and financial theory haven't shifted that much.
Right.
And, you know, if you do an MBA at London Business School or Columbia or wherever, I'm not sure how different that looks today than it did 10 or 20 years ago. You start to see things are changing where the education of leaders, future leaders, is changing, but we're still treating these things as peripheral. So the idea that you should be a responsible business and think about the outside world and your impact on it is still a peripheral part of a business school curricula. You know, that is starting to shift, but business schools still fundamentally need to change. So we're training people to run organizations largely in a system that hasn't changed that much in the last 50, 60 right. years. And so learned experience is shaped by that. Our business models are still the same. So when our work in the legal sector, we're talking to law firms that have had the same model for decade after decade after decade, and it served the purpose of the people that run those organizations. I succeeded because we billed time and we charged time and we targeted billable hours. And so naturally, there is a lot of discomfort around change. We can, you know, that what we've tended to find is that if you can show, you know, what's possible, and you can show a pathway which isn't about, you know, radically reshaping the organization and tearing everything up and starting again, but actually just moving the organization into a different place, which almost comes back to where you started pointing. It's like, well, look, don't just pay lip. Don't just talk about caring about people, you know, practice it and build that into your thinking and your mindset. And then you can start to think about possibilities.
In that specific vein, when we were doing our pre-conversation, we were talking about the unintended consequence. Maybe it's an intentional consequence, but I can't imagine it. But let's call it the unintended consequence of reinforcing behavior around things like billable hours. So, you know, and how that alters individuals' behaviors, for example, away from relationship building. And what's the cost to an organization in doing that, or quality service, right? If it's about the number of hours I'm billing, and not about the relationship, my level of understanding about the client or the client's outcomes, I potentially run the risk of billing lots of hours to a client who doesn't necessarily feels heard at the end of the day, and then losing that client, which means that in order for me to bill those hours next year, I need to find a whole new client, instead of putting aside time that says, this is about me understanding who you are and what you need, understanding what the thesis for the work that you're doing is, how it is your organization operates, and where it is I or we, my team, can be of best service to you, thereby creating a reinforcing relationship where you come back. I mean, it's the net promoter score idea. It's, you know, recurring business, those kinds of things. But so often we see in those kinds of T&M environments, it being transactional and not relational. And that's a huge risk to organizations.
Yeah. It's been built into the system that it is a transactional relationship. You know, we talk to a lot of clients of law firms as well. So generally, you know, general counsel, you know, in-house legal teams, and they very much, you know, most of them very much make the same point that you're making, which is, you know, our relationship is largely transactional. When there's, you know, when there's a problem, we go to the lawyers and we get it dealt with. You know, there isn't the, you know, chart. The incentive and need to charge time means that naturally anything other than charging time to a client, you're under pressure not to do. You know, you don't. So where is the space for spending, you know, time with your client to understand them? I mean, I talked to a law firm quite recently, literally last month, and they said, you know, there are partners in the organization, I can say who is, but they don't take associates to client meetings or client pitches. And I just was like, well, sorry, on, you know, what basis do you do that? And you know, and it was just extraordinary. It was almost like, you know, isn't that about investing in the people you're taking along?
Right.
Who learn about the client, understand the client, be part of a team that's providing service to the client rather than seen through the lens of one partner. So, you know, it was almost like, you know, they didn't want the team, you know, they didn't want a feeling. I think there was a number of issues, but part of it is if you take a couple of people along to a meeting and you can't charge the time because it's development time, then, you know, that's going to look bad on your own targets as a partner. I think there's also issues of control. You know, the partner, a lot of partners like to feel like they're the only one that can give client service. But the underlying point is also the system is incentivizing and supporting that kind of behavior. It's almost justifying that kind of behavior through the lens of how you're managing the business. Whereas on the flip side, even when I worked in professional services, someone who joined on day one, if I was going to a client, I'd take them with me and say, look, you know, we might not be able to bill this time, but this is about your learning. And actually, the more you learn, the less I have to do, because I can, you know, you can become more involved. And actually, if there are two of us that the client trusts or three of us that the client trusts, I might be the main point of contact, but over time you become the main point of contact. And you know, to your point, you develop a high trust relationship. Right. And I think that's true of many corporate environments where, you know, again, we have a system built around transactions. Suppliers are, you know, historically been brought in, you know, to reduce cost and try and deliver the same level of quality. It's why we, you know, manufacture stuff in different parts of the world and we shift locations, you know, when tariffs hit or we find a lower cost, somewhere gets more expensive and so on and so forth. But we don't invest time, you know, this long-term relationship building around, you know, understanding that over a long period of time, that human relationship is a value one. It's not just over time, you know, the cost of whatever they provide goes down and actually you start to get more value from that investment. Mm-hmm. And I think that plays out across the whole piece, right? So, you know, why would you spend time, you know, thinking up new products and innovations or making the organization work better, more efficiently if that's time you can't charge to a client? So this comes back to the idea of why, you know, the model in itself does not encourage highly efficient organizations. And it's probably one of the reasons why, you know, the legal sector has seen an influx of private equity investments where they can see organizations where the quality of management generally is mediocre and where there's a lot of complacency and a lot of room to improve. The thing about PE is it comes in, it can be quite brutal around how it, you know, cuts off the fat, so to speak. Not necessarily in a human way, but you know, you've got organizations who are largely inefficient and they're ripe for disruption.
Mm-hmm. All of this brings back to mind, I don't know that you've seen it, but the 2025 intangible asset study that Ocean Tomo does periodically, their 25 study came out 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it continues to show this massive, particularly in the United States, but in other areas as well, but it shows this massive inversion since 1965 or 1975 market value, right? And now they're saying 92% of the fair market value, the S&P 500 market value, is generated in these intangible asset categories, right? Largely built on humans and human capital, creativity, programming, design, innovation, service delivery, and all of those things, intellectual property. And yet we are still in a place where educational systems and the framework for understanding value creation for businesses is largely still indexed on property, plant, and equipment, which now only make up 8% of that market value. We see that there's an inflection that has to happen, but it isn't happening, right? There's this incredible tension in that space.
Yeah, I know it's interesting. If it's 92, I know 10 years ago we worked with a senior CFO that said 80 at the time. So maybe that it may well be that percentage has grown, right? So the bulk of that if the bulk of the value creation is human, how on earth are you not measuring and managing that in a more sophisticated way than you're doing? How are you, on earth are you only managing one or two factors within the whole value set, right? Because, you know, if you look at every other asset within the organization, it gets used in whatever, you know, the best way possible. But in, you know, with human beings, we just ask for, you know, how many products you can do, how many deliveries you can do, how many hours you can put on the clock, you know, how many goals you can score. You know, it's we're very reductionist and therefore we don't realize that human potential, right? We reduce everything down to very, very simple things. And, you know, consequently, we miss an enormous amount. I mean, you just look at the way AI is being has been introduced in the last couple of years, and it's like the whole, we've seen this wave after wave. When there's, you know, when everybody was outsourcing, great, we can get rid of jobs. When we've got robots, great, we can get rid of jobs. Now we've got AI, great, we can get rid of jobs. And nope, it's just like, oh, whoa. It's like, let's just think about this a little bit, right? So, you know, the value in a law firm is the relationship between the lawyer and the client. Where does that value, you know, how does that person, you know, get all the knowledge and expertise and experience necessary to provide that service? And, you know, it doesn't come out of technology. I think we've kind of reached the point where we've still got firms that are cutting and saying it's down to AI. And then we've got other firms like IBM saying, oh, we've just taken the biggest cohort of graduates that we've ever taken on.
Uh-huh, right.
There's IBM folks. So it's right. Like, why are they doing that? Well, yeah, I mean, generally, I mean, certainly in a legal context, the way AI is being integrated is that it means that a lot of the really hard, labor intensive, going through, you know, papers and books and stuff is done extremely quickly. But, you know, rather than seeing that as liberating hours in which a person could generate a really great relationship with our client.
Right.
And probably get two or three more projects alongside of the job they were doing. It's like, oh, we don't need that person anymore. I mean, it's just because everything's about the cost of the individual rather than the value potential of that individual.
Right. Well, and that's reinforced by the way business is valued and it accounts for its value creation, right? People don't live on the balance sheet. They are considered an expense. You know, they're not investable in that way. So, you know, it goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about things like education, right? We're in the world of education, we're in the world of financial accounting standards, corporate valuation practices, all of those kinds of things. Does the market value actually impact those models so that it is not so easy to, you know, sit at a board table and say, let's just get rid of people, that will deflate our cost, instead of really looking at where value is truly being created. You know, we really are at this very interesting shift.
You know, and I think some of the problem has been that we've, you know, accountants have a little bit to take responsibility here for, because they've tried to put a value on human capital and right. Put people on the balance sheet. And my view, and I think, you know, the way what we're doing today is actually, that's the wrong way to look at it. You've got to look at how people create outcomes, financial right. outcomes, okay. quality outcomes, you know, the value factors which drive the performance of the individual and the profit and loss on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. When you understand that relationship, then you can make a connection between, you know, healthier profitability and then enterprise value, right?
Right.
Which talks to market value, if you like, of, you know, share prices yeah. and so on and so forth. You know, that's why Toyota has outperformed its peers, is because the maturity or the way they've managed human beings as a source, fundamental source of value, every human being, has been priced in over time.
Right. Right.
That has been priced in. That has been recognized in the market mm-hmm. value of that company. Similarly with Handelsbanken and others. You know, that's the point. Trying to put a value on people tends to, again, it reinforces the cost lens, right? Because
right.
you start with the cost right. of an individual, and then you try and look at the lifetime, you know, work of that person or a whole workforce group, and you come up with a number. You know, I've sat in many of meetings with accountants that, you know, we've come up with a number, and I'm just saying this is the wrong, it's the wrong road to go down. You're not looking at this the right way around. And so, yeah, again, ironically, in building the idea and a platform around a human value operating system, the people I've been working with are finance people. They are accountants, but, you know, they're instrumental in building a system where you can capture that contribution, pull together the data, measure it in the right way, be able to communicate it, put it together in a you know, a composite number which tells you something about value creation from an individual to a group of people to a whole location to a whole country of people. And that's for me is the most, you know, that's really exciting, you know, because, you know, had this idea for quite a long time now that's the way we should be approaching things. We've got to build a value system that continues to capture this data. We can track these things. We can then start to look at how our investments in people make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. We do lots of leadership development. How much of that moves the performance needle at all? But if we're capturing all the value indicators on a weekly, monthly basis, we can see how that may or may not affect things. And suddenly we've got something incredibly powerful. We're not waiting for the engagement scores to come out, you know, once a year, 3 months after we've done the survey, or, you know, the quarterly pulse survey, which doesn't tell us too much, or, you know, and we don't let data that just drift off into a data warehouse and sit there. We're actually bringing it out and using it. And for me, you know, we are, you know, companies are awash with data, but on the when it comes to people analytics and people metrics, it's often seen in a very fragmented, siloed way, rather than bringing it all together in a way where I can see as a whole, you know, where are our value concentrations? Where are we realizing potential? Where are we missing it? Where have we got signals of withdrawal and potential exit or potential toxicity? Where's the hypothesis between, you know, people and locations that fundamentally care and love their people and those that and what are the differences, you know?
Right. Stuart, I thank you for today's conversation and for the work that you and your peers at NextView are doing to help illustrate and elucidate what the data shows and then how to use this data for benefit, both in discrete organizations, but I think more largely and broadly speaking across systems that we know are impacted and increased economic value for those organizations and for their communities and families as well, right? Like when we are loving these people, that has ripple effects across the world. It really helps to create a generative economy.
Yeah. I don't think we should, you know, a national level. I mean, we were contacted by a Japanese government ministry 10 years ago. We were even contacted by a Chinese state who came and we taught them. You know, they saw that this stuff mattered, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know, the reality is that, you know, people who are well at work mentally and physically and go home and take that wellness home are going to be, you know, they're not taking home stress and angst and problems, and which we know has a as you say, a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that, you know, work doesn't necessarily just cause ill health and problems to an individual. It can, you know, has a much broader effect to friends and family. And we've seen that very acutely in the legal sector, where there's been more than one person who's died by suicide, and it's been fairly well recognized that work was at least a contributory factor to that outcome. And of course, the trauma and the grief that then causes is huge. And it's, you know, nobody wants that. Again, this stuff is not soft and nice to have. Fundamentally, it talks to healthy people, organizations, and societies in a bigger context.
Yeah, super point. Stuart, share with our audience, if you would, how to get in touch with you.
Oh, well, LinkedIn's always a good way. if you want to, nextview.co.uk is where we are building our human value operating system. We would love to talk to people, and we're talking to people in lots of different places and getting feedback. So far, the feedback has been amazing. I've just been blown away. We're hoping we should be going to a big legal tech event in London in June. And someone came and talked to me and said, I hadn't met them before. And they said, I know about you, Stuart. And I said, why is that? And because you're exciting the legal tech world, because they've never seen anything like what you're producing. And I said, no, well, not before time, but yeah, it's genuinely exciting. But, we want to succeed, not just because that'll mean we've commercially succeeded, because we want to make a difference in terms of mm-hmm. making organizations better places, which is where we started with the Maturity Institute. over 10 years ago. So yeah, if you want to look at maturityinstitute.com, that's another place to go where there's a lot of, you'll see a lot of our work around how we assess and rate organizations and capture the human value drivers that really do make a difference in creating organizations that put people first.
Thank you for spreading the love. It means so much to us, and together, I think we'll all make a difference. It's so nice to spend time with you again, Stuart. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.